think one of the first sort of nerdy computer films about hacking and things like that that I can remember was one from the early 80s. I'm not even sure that I've got the name right, but I think it was called War Games. And I think it was about this young computer nerd guy that hacked into, like, the Russian and American nuclear power, nuclear weapons control systems, and thought he was playing a game or something like that, but he was actually firing up nuclear weapons. Something like that. I can't remember the exact plot, but it was one of those sorts of things. And that was in an era where people were really acutely aware of the potential for nuclear war. This is before the sort of, you know, arms reduction treaties that came into place in the mid-80s between America and Russia, and people started reducing their stockpiles of nuclear weapons. And that was a real thing. And it's shocking, isn't it, that in these days that people are then are again talking about the potential of intended or unintended nuclear conflagrations. And it's like, we've had COVID, we've had floods, now we've got nuclear war. What else? And I saw in one of my social media feeds during the week someone referencing a quote by C.S. Lewis relating to atomic potential for atomic annihilation. And I guess I thought I'd read it because this sort of provides a framework, and we're going to be sort of digging into a few things after that. But this is what it's, and this is like written in 1948 or 1950 or something like that. In one way, we think a great deal too much of the atomic bomb. How are we to live in an atomic age? I am tempted to reply, why, as you would have lived in the 16th century when the plague visited London almost every year, or as you would have lived in the Viking Age when raiders from Scandinavia might land and cut your throat any night, or indeed as you are already living in an age of cancer, an age of syphilis, an age of paralysis, an age of air raids, an age of railway accidents, an age of motor accidents. In other words, do not let us begin by exaggerating the novelty of our situation. Believe me, dear sir or madam, you and all whom you love were already sentenced to death before the atomic bomb was invented, and quite a high percentage of us were going to die in unpleasant ways. I'm saying it like it pretty bluntly, isn't he? We had, indeed, one very great advantage over our ancestors, anaesthetics, but we have that still. It is perfectly ridiculous to go about whimpering and drawing long faces because the scientists have added one more chance of painful and premature death to a world which already bristled with such chances, and in which death itself was not a chance at all, but a certainty. This is the first point to be made, and the first action to be taken is to pull ourselves together. If we are all going to be destroyed by an atomic bomb, let that bomb, when it comes, find us doing sensible and human things. Praying, working, teaching, reading, listening to music, bathing the children, playing tennis, chatting to our friends over a pint and a game of darts, not huddled together like frightened sheep and thinking about bombs. They may bake our bodies, a microbe can do that, but they need not dominate our minds. A fairly challenging reframing of the situations that we might be facing. And I think in recent times, the shock deaths of the Labor senator just the other day and of Shane Warne and people like that also bring all of these things much more to the foreground, don't they? And it I must have the most random news feed coming in on my phone, but in it I saw there was an article or an ad or something for some company in Japan that was basically selling nuclear shelters that you could install in your house. You'd buy these things, you'd install it on the inside of your house and it would protect you from radiation and other things. No. And so people are going to fork out money for that. They're doing disaster prep. And so today I want us, in the first half of our time together, to just reflect on some disaster prepping from a spiritual perspective. And then in the second half, we're sort of like we've got two little sermons in one today. In the second half, we're going to be talking about some theology about Jesus as we lead into Easter. And that's why I asked you to open up your EBC Bible reading app to just before, because those of you that use it regularly will know that Monday through Saturday, we slowly work our way through the whole Bible by reading sequential bits of the Old and New Testament and a bit of Psalms, so that when we go through 1 year, we've read half the Old Testament, half the New Testament, and all of the book of Psalms. And then the next year, we read the second half of the Old Testament, the second half of the New Testament, and all of the book of Psalms again. But on Sundays, there are lectionary readings. And on lectionary readings, they have a snippet from the Old Testament, a snippet from the New Testament, that's the letters, a bit from the Gospels, and also a bit from the Psalms. And it's out of sequence to the rest of things. It's like there's two separate things going on. The first one is helping us work through the Bible to get the overall big picture. The second one is giving us snapshots of things that sometimes link together. And today I want to be us reflecting on two of the readings for today, which are Psalm 27 and Luke 13. So the first part is Psalm 27. And one of the best things that we can do to improve our prayer life and our life with God is to immerse ourselves in the Psalms. The Psalms are a record of people's conversations with God. And sometimes they're praises, sometimes they're wisdom, sometimes they're the laments crying out to God. But if we just think like my prayer life or my conversation with God is stuck in a rut, well, get into the Psalms. You'll find a variety of things there that way people express themselves to God that will expand your way of expressing yourself to God as well. And you might even find in the poetry there words that help you articulate things to God that you have had trouble articulating yourself. But one of the things that the Psalms do is they help us create a life that is centered around God. And this psalm, Psalm 27 in a way, can be used as a bit of disaster prepping. And also, to be honest, if we're in the middle of a disaster, this can be a good psalm to use as well. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is a stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked advance against me to devour me, it is my enemies and my foes who will stumble and fall. Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. Though war break out against me, even then I will be confident. You see, so the psalmist here is recognising that these things are coming. You know. And I think there's a passage somewhere, I think, in the life of David where the incident where he goes and gets tempted and with Bathsheba. And I think it says at the beginning of that story, at the season when the kings went out to war, it's like, well, it's a bit, you know, like you have summer and winter and sowing and reaping, and also the time when you have war. It's just like a regular thing on the calendar. And now we have been very fortunate in Australia where we haven't been exposed to that, but we've been exposed to the reality of it in Ukraine and other places in our TV sets in recent times. But, you know, when the Bible was written and all those sort of things, people regularly face floods and droughts and earthquakes and famines and wars and pestilences and all sorts of things. And in the midst of that reality of the difficulties of life, they found this reality of their relationship with God. And the psalmist here is talking about, even though I'm facing these things, I'm not going to be afraid. Then from verse 4, one thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze on the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. For in the day of trouble, he will keep me safe in his dwelling. He will hide me in the shelter of his sacred tent and set me high upon a rock. Then my head will be exalted above the enemies who surround me. At his sacred tent, I will sacrifice with shouts of joy. I will sing and make music to the Lord. And so here the psalmist is focusing his life around God. In the midst of all of the other things that are going on, one thing I ask, this that I seek, that I might dwell in your house, God. And then he cries out more urgently in verse 7, hear my voice when I call, Lord, be merciful to me and answer me. My heart says of you, seek his face, your face, Lord, I will seek. Do not hide your face from me. Do not turn your servant away in anger. You have been my helper. Do not reject me or forsake me, my God. Though my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will receive me. Teach me your way, Lord. Teach me, lead me in a straight path because of my oppressors. Do not turn me over to the desires of my foes, or false witnesses rise up against me spouting malicious accusations. I remain confident of this. I will see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. That's a great psalm that expresses a person's life focused on God. In the midst of all the other things that are going on, it's focused on God and about being with God. And we know that, as we've talked about before, that in fact, whenever we are in this world, we are in a place that is the cathedral of creation where God dwells. And sometimes there might be the dichotomy of the beauty of creation and the horror of people acting badly in that creation right next to each other. You know, you have the beauty of a flower with a bomb going off next to it. But in the midst of the devastation, there is God is still there. And so this psalmist was reminding himself to seek God's face, reminding himself to look to God. Doing it now before the disaster happens, before the enemies attack. And then in the midst of when the enemies attack, he would be much better prepared to continue to do that because that's the thing that he knows is going to sustain him. And so I encourage you to do a bit of an inventory. How much of your life is doom scrolling and how much of your life is God's face seeking? How much of your day is spent scrolling through your social media feed or watching the news or whatever else and being filled with all of the doom things that are happening or might happen? And how much of your day are you spending focusing and seeking and telling yourself, seek God's face. I want to be with you, God. More than with CNN. Because if we build the habits now, when we get into the crisis later, it will be our automatic response. And so this and many other psalms, in fact, I read the psalms around Psalm 27 in the lead up to this, and there's just lots of psalms there about people focusing their life around God. And so let me encourage you to say, well, God, what's a simple way that I can be more proactive in focusing my life around you, God? What's the best way that I can do that? And the more that I do that now, the more automatic it will be in the moment of crisis. And so I encourage you to renew your engagement with the Psalms. Whether that's reading the little snippet that we have every day, whether it's for a season reading lots, like Billy Graham used to read through the whole book of Psalms every month. Or whether it's taking a particular psalm and memorising parts of it and really letting that one seep into your life. And that's what one of the things that I've done quite regularly. Is to pick one psalm and memorise it, and that almost be like my psalm for the month or the season or the year, and just regularly come back to that. Spiritual disaster prepping. Part two, totally, well, in many ways disconnected from the one, and that's the reading from Luke chapter 13. At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you." He replied, "Go tell that fox, I will keep on driving out demons and healing people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I'll reach my goal. In any case, I must press on today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those who sent you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" When we're coming to Easter, we naturally again are focusing again in a concentrated way on the person of Jesus and who he is and what he has done. And there's lots of different ways we can think about Jesus, but in these next few sermons, that we're just going to have a time to think about sort of aspects of Jesus that can be understood from key types of people from the Old Testament. I was reading Acts chapter 2 the other day with Fu, who some of you will know back from Stonington days, a guy from China who was part of our church for a while. And we were reading through Acts chapter 2, and the day of Pentecost comes, and then Peter gets up to explain it. And it struck me how in his sermon to the crowd, he explains the situation that's going on in terms of Old Testament passages, whether it's from Joel or Psalm 16 or Psalm 110. It's like when he's trying to get a framework for explaining what's going on, he looks back to the Old Testament to help explain the amazing and surprising and extraordinary events of the life, death and resurrection of Jesus and the pouring out of the Holy Spirit. And so when we come to this Easter, we can also look back to the Old Testament to explain Jesus. And here in this passage, Jesus identifies himself as a prophet. He says, "Go tell that fox, I will keep on driving out demons and healing people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I'll reach my goal. In any case, I must press on today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside Jerusalem." And so Jesus here is identifying himself as a prophet, and this links back to the category of people that was prominent in the Old Testament, and that is of prophets. People who would hear God and speak God's words for themselves and for others. And if you go through the Old Testament, you're familiar with the Old Testament, there are two other categories as well of significant people, and they are priests and kings. And we are going to see and be reminded in the lead up to Easter that Jesus is preeminently the prophet, priest and king. And if we're trying to understand and appreciate in greater depth who he is, one of the things that we can do is that we can think about Jesus through these three Old Testament categories. And it wasn't just Jesus saying that. In fact, when Peter was in the book of Acts, he was had gone, you know, to the temple to pray and met a lame man on the way, and he asked for arms and he gave him legs, he was walking and leaping and praising God. When Peter is then explaining to people what's going on, and then he talks about how they crucified Jesus and how they did it in ignorance, etc., he then goes in Acts chapter 3, verse 22, "For Moses said, 'The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among the people, your own people. You must listen to everything he tells you. Anyone who does not listen to him will be completely cut off from their people.'" And this is a quote from Deuteronomy chapter 18, where Moses is saying, "After me there's going to come a prophet that God's going to raise up, and you better listen to him." And here, in terms of trying to make sense of this extraordinary person, Jesus, Peter is here saying, well, one of the ways that we make sense of him is that he is the prophet that Moses told us to look out for. He is the prophet that Moses told us to listen to. And it wasn't just Peter that had that view as well. When Stephen, who was about to get stoned, is giving his defense, if you like, in front of the religious rulers, he also quotes exactly the same thing. When he's telling the story of Israel and Moses, etc., he says in chapter 7, verse 37 of Acts, "This is the Moses who told the Israelites, 'God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people.'" And so when we are thinking about who Jesus is, he is to be understood in one respect as the prophet. Now, it's not the only respect. He's the Son of God, he's the Son of Man, he's the King, he's the priest as well. But as we're trying to grasp and reflect on who Jesus is, we need to understand that he's also the prophet, the one who preeminently hears God and speaks what God says. And Jesus himself said that. in John chapter 8, verse 28. It says, "The Son of Man, then you will know that I am he and that I do nothing on my own, but speak just what the Father has taught me." So Jesus himself was self-aware that he was hearing his Father's words and speaking his Father's words to those around him. And I want to finish this by taking us back to the Transfiguration. And Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up on a mountain. And then Jesus is transfigured, and then a cloud appeared and covered them, and a voice came from the cloud, "This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." And that's the deepest and most profound thing that we can do if we really want to act as if it's true that Jesus is the prophet. If Jesus really is speaking God's words, then we need to make a high priority of listening to Jesus. And so in some ways, Psalm 27 and Luke 13 are linked. Psalm 27 is about seeking God and orientating your life around God. And when Psalm 13 points us to the reality that Jesus is the one who speaks God's words to us, that provides another concrete way that we can center our life around God. We can make it a priority to listen to Jesus' words. And we believe Jesus speaks to us by his Spirit right now, and we've even shared some of those for us today. But it also, preeminently in terms of written words, the Gospels record Jesus' words and his actions. And they take up, the Gospels in the book of Acts take up more than half of the New Testament. And so we can do much worse than immersing ourselves in the Gospels. Reading them regularly, reading parts of them and turning them over and over in our minds, paying attention to what Jesus did, but also to what Jesus said. Because it must have been pretty important for God to come and descend and speak out of a cloud, "This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." We're in a season of Lent, and in many liturgical traditions, people give up things for Lent. You might like to think about, how can I give up some things for Lent this year that might provide extra space for me to focus my life around God and to really listen to Jesus? Is there some TV show that you can press pause on for a while? Many people fast during Lent. And the process of giving up a meal provides extra space for you to focus on God, and the rumbling of your tummy also reminds you to focus on God as well. Maybe you were going to say, "I'm going to read the Gospels, particularly the last week of Jesus' life, and really just soak in that." And if you're not a reader, maybe the good thing is that there are dramatized versions of the Gospels and there's audio versions of the Gospels. You can listen to them, you can watch them. If you're not a great reader, there's plenty of ways that you can be really immersing yourself in Jesus and listening to his words. So as we come to the close of our service and the team comes back up to lead us in our final song, I just want you to pause for a moment and think about how today, how tomorrow might I focus my life around God? How might I listen to Jesus? What's the simple thing that you can do that's within your capacity, given your current life circumstance, to do that just a little bit more? So you might like to just close your eyes and say, God, this is the way that I want to do that. But I need your help to do that. I know I can't do it by myself. So I just invite you to bow your head and pray and just interact with God in that regard. Amen.